Hachette Audio presents Inhibitor Phase, written by Alistair Reynolds, read by John Lee. Preface. Dear listener, this is a novel set in the Revelation Space Universe. While it shares some connective tissue with some of the other books and stories in that sequence, it's my hope that it can be read independently. In addition, while there are callbacks to events and characters from earlier in the history, I've tried to avoid significant spoilers for the other titles. If you want to dive into the book cold, please do so and skip the rest of this introduction. If you'd like a little more orientation, but not too much, then here is the essential setup. About 500 years from now, humanity has spread into interstellar space and settled many nearby solar systems. There have been good times and bad, golden ages, factional wars, a devastating plague. While exploring the ruins of a vanished alien civilization, humans managed to trigger a long-dormant threat from the dawn of time. Remorseless, cube-shaped, replicating machines, inhibitors, emerge from the darkness and begin culling humanity. Over the next 200 years, humans and their allies, including hive-mind conjoiners and genetically engineered hyperpigs, band together, squabble, and generally go to ever more extreme ends to find a weapon against the inhibitors, also known as wolves. These measures all fail to one degree or another. By the late years of the 28th century, all that's left of humanity is a few isolated pockets of survivors, hunkering down with ever more limited resources, and still no real idea how to fight back against the wolves. This is where Inhibitor Phase begins. Part 1. Sun Hollow. Chapter 1. Victorine was painting a wall. I looked down at her as she added a touch of detail to the mural's darkening edge. Cubes swarmed in from space, each rendered in two efficient strokes of midnight, blue and black. They stood out against the ruddier background of the dust disk, gathering into sinuous, straggly formations, loops and chains, before coagulating into larger and more ominous forms, dark, dense masses prickling with lightning like an armada of thunderheads. Victorine had done none of that. It was all the work of other schoolchildren, some long grown or long gone. But she was adding to it, layering paint over paint. From out of the thunderheads burst a pack of creatures, twisted, straining, mad-eyed forms of muscle and claw, fur and tooth. "I know they're not really wolves," she said, anticipating any remark I might have been about to make. "I know that's just what we call them. But they might as well be wolves." "You've never seen wolves." "I don't need to." "They're a reminder of what drove us here," I said quietly. "That's why they're on the mural. But you're painting them as if they're about to pounce out of the sky. Is that how you feel?" Victorine set her brush down on the lip of the metal box she cradled in her other arm. The materials inside it were improvised, chemical pigments and stabilizing emulsions that had once served some other purpose in the great plan of settlement. There were colors denied to her, because the right ingredients had never been found, or could not be spared for something as frivolous as a school mural. Her brushes were crude sticks, tipped with coarse eruptions of stiff animal hair from the cattle stocks we kept for food and clothing. The paint box was itself the front compartment of a life support pack, long since dismantled and repurposed for its vital treasures. That Victorine could make any sort of mark on the wall was something of a miracle. In fact, her wolves were alive with a desperate energy and purpose. "What do you think I ought to feel?" she asked, in answer to my query. A deep, resonant thud shook the ground. It shook everything. We looked up. Up from the wall. Up from the school. Up to the ceiling of rock far above us. A second thud came again, and a rain of dirt and dust loosened itself from the ceiling. The ceiling's lights flickered and died. A third thud came, harder than before. Heavier stones and boulders began to detach. Screams sounded across the cavern. Victorine was calm, though.
"They're here,"
she said, taking a step back from her work.
"They're here and they want to break in."
Her tone became quietly accusatory. It means you failed, Miguel. It means you failed, and everything here is going to end. She dipped her brush into its little jar of cleaning solvent and stirred it methodically. The thudding became the low throb of the wake-up alarm. The stir of Victorine's brush was the high, cyclical tone of air circulation pumps purring to life. The sting of the debris against my eyes was the discomfort of forcing them wide after weeks of sleep. I was awake. Awake and inside the torpor box. For a moment, lying weightless, it was enough to know that I had survived the crossing, that the ship and its components had held together long enough to bring me to the interception point. Given the state of our equipment and defenses, that alone was something to thank. The torpor boxes were good enough to keep us in hibernation for a few weeks, but they were nowhere near as reliable as the long-duration reefer sleep caskets that we had once taken for granted. Every trip involving a period of torpor carried a risk of death or permanent disability. I had rolled the dice once and survived. I would be rolling it at least one more time before my return to Sun Hollow. I waited a minute, gathering my strength, and set about removing the box's monitors and catheters. When that slow, painful business was done, I took another few moments and examined myself with the detached, methodical eye of a physician. The box's blue light laid me out unsparingly. Blemishes, scars, poor muscle tone, white hairs. All old news. A few fresh pressure sores, some bruising, bleeding here and there. The usual numbness and tremor in my fingers. Nothing, though, that was going to kill me in the next few hours. The memories of the last few days before my departure were still fresh. The detection, the confirmation, the decision to interdict. My volunteering for the operation. The arguments against and for. The tears and the strained farewells that followed. Saying goodbye to Nicola and Victorine. The launch boost, blasting away from the false-bottomed crater over Sun Hollow's shuttle pen. The strain on my bones as the shuttle accelerated, gaining speed while it still had the cover of the circumstellar dust disk. 10 G's, 4.7 hours. I had been unconscious for most of that, mercifully, and had only endured it because of a suite of aggressive life support measures, taking the load off my heart and lungs. My spine still ached from the twin abuses of compression under acceleration, and now the slow, painful unloading under weightlessness. Hard on a young man, murderous on a relic like me. Why had I volunteered for this? I had to dig deeper into my memories for that. Hitting them was like finding a loose tooth jangling against a nerve. An instant, savage hit of raw agony. Ah, yes. That was why. Political atonement. I was making amends for a mistake, a blemish on my office, after a badly managed coup against me failed. After a contentious trial and a botched execution. Rurik Tain, writhing on the floor, not quite dead. My fault, all of it. Nothing that was enough to unseat me from office. Nothing criminal, just a series of bad judgments, but enough to undermine the trust vested in me. The trust I had fought so hard to earn since the founding of Sun Hollow. I swallowed back any self-pity. Doing this had been my choice, not something forced on me. Allies and doubters alike had tried to argue me out of it. But I had known that the only path to redemption lay in the acceptance of my duty. Now I had a task to finish. Once I was free of revival grogginess, I extracted myself from the box and floated through to the control cabin with its pilot's positions and faintly glowing instrumentation. Although the ship could easily accommodate a larger crew, I was alone aboard it. I settled into the middle seat and brought the readouts to normal illumination while keeping the windows shuttered. Satisfied that the ship was in good health, the engineers had done well to keep it spaceworthy, I turned to communications, hoping for an update on the status of the incomer. It would have suited me very well to learn that it was a false alarm, a data mirage, or that the crew had come to some change of heart, reversing for interstellar space and leaving us in peace. No such respite. It was still there, still coming in on a direct course for Michaelmas and Sun Hollow. I refined my position, using cold gas thrusters to minimize the likelihood of being seen. 30 million kilometers still separated my ship from the incomer, but that was a scratch against the size of the system. Our relative speed was a little under 4,000 kilometers per second, 2 hours until we were on each other. I moved back to the missile bay, opened a pressure hatch, and peered in to inspect the weapon, making sure no harm had come to it during launch. There was only one missile, a thick, round-ended cylinder 2 meters long, fixed into a deployable launch cradle. The arming panel was a flattened area of the casing, set with black controls. At my touch, a matrix of red lights glimmered from the casing. They went through a startup cycle, then held steady, indicating readiness. With the hatch sealed, I depressurized the missile bay, then opened the outer door and lowered the cradle until it was projecting beyond the hull. I returned to the command deck. Missile inspection, arming and launch readiness had taken less than 10 minutes. I loaded the tactical input from the shuttle's main console into the missile, giving it an up-to-date model for the incomer's position and speed. I double-checked communications, just in case word had come in to break the attack. None had arrived. So I waited until our relative distance had narrowed to a mere 2 million kilometers, then let the missile loose. The cradle's restraints opened and the weapon streaked away without fanfare, boosting to close up the distance. I watched for a response from the incomer, some sudden evasive swerve, but there was no change in its approach. Nothing about that surprised me. If the incomer had been capable of detecting the missile, the same capability should have given away my position long ago. According to the console, the missile was maintaining its lock on the incomer. It would slip like a dagger between the drive beams and auto-destruct a microsecond before impact. From a distance, the matter-antimatter blast would be indistinguishable from a conjoined drive malfunction, the selfsame malfunction that was bound to follow an instant later when the ship broke apart. With the deed all but done, I permitted my thoughts to turn to the sleepers on that ship. I still had no idea how many there were, or where and when they had commenced their journey. We would never know. But I like to think that they had gone to their hibernation berths with no fear in their hearts, no intimation of the terror that must have detected them, and then chased them across the stars, forcing them to this desperate, final bolt hole. Someday we would find a way to mourn them. It was not that we were murderers by nature, or that we had anything against the crew and passengers of that ship. Doubtless they were just looking for somewhere to shelter from the wolves. A quiet, out-of-the-way sanctuary. An unobvious hiding place. It was why we had selected Michaelmas. Why we had selected this whole system, and presumably they had been guided by the same logic. But we had already done it. We had dug ourselves into the crust of Michaelmas, and we had years of survival to prove that we were good at lying low. We had never given ourselves away, and we had no intention of doing so, which was why this bright, clumsy visitor could not be tolerated. Even if they did not know of our presence, even if they never became aware of it, they might still be leading wolves right to our door. So they had to die, and in a manner that looked like accidental destruction. The console flashed red, synchronized with a piercing warning tone. To my consternation, the missile had developed a steering anomaly. There was nothing I could do but observe, reading the faint telemetry trace. A low bandwidth crackle designed to blend in with the radio frequency noise coming out of Michael. The cold gas thruster had jammed at one of its extreme deflections, making the missile begin to veer. I cursed our luck. The steering fault was a known factor with the improvised missiles. We were asking them to perform far outside their design envelope, but we had done all that we could to mitigate the problem. "Correct yourself," I whispered. The missile was waggling hard. At any moment, the G-forces might be sufficient to jolt the thruster out of its jammed position. There was still a chance. But the console flashed again. A different readout now. A different warning tone. Interception null, interception null, interception null. The mathematics could not be argued with. The missile's contortions had pushed it too far off course. A Unless the incomer, obliged by changing its own course, there was no longer any means by which the missile could achieve a kill. "Abort and self-protect," I told the missile. My words were reserved for the console alone, which contained just enough artificial intelligence to understand natural language. All that was transmitted to the missile was a burst of prearranged binary code. The missile would attempt to use whatever was left of its fuel to put itself into a safe-keeping orbit, allowing it to be recovered at some point in the future. As difficult as that exercise might prove, it was better than losing a warhead. I now knew what must be done. I had always known it might be necessary, but I had pushed it to the back of my mind while there was hope that our first line of defense might be sufficient. Now that the missile had failed, though, I had to fall back on our only other means of stopping the lighthugger. It was not as surgical and, if anything, was even more costly to Sun Hollow, and crucially, I would not have the satisfaction of knowing that it had succeeded. But there was no alternative. "Protocol 2," I told the shuttle. "Zero abort." "Validation?" "Cydonia," I said, using the code word I had prearranged. The shuttle accepted my instructions. Its own cold gas jets began to pop, lining it up ever more precisely with the incomer. It would be trying to follow the same intended trajectory as the missile, slipping between the drive beams. Hard for a missile, harder still for a bulky shuttle. But at least it no longer mattered if a little of the incomer's drive radiation seeped through the hull. I had no munitions, so the destructive power of my shuttle lay solely in its mass and speed. It would be sufficient. I was calmer than I had expected. There was no room now for doubt or failure of nerve. I had assigned all necessary control to the shuttle and removed any possibility of rescinding that authority. I could wrestle with the controls, beg for my life, but no failure of my nerve would make a difference. I was going to die. In doing so, I would condemn however many innocents were on that ship. But I would save the 5,000 of us who lived in Sun Hollow, including the woman I loved and the daughter she had allowed into my world. I visualized Nicola and Victorine, alone at our table. Nicola starting to break the news. Victorine absorbing it, holding her composure for brave seconds before the truth undid her. I was not her father, and would never know a daughter's love, but I believed that she had become fond of me. I steeled myself and watched the impact clock tick down to zero. There was a white burst, and for a foolish moment I thought it was the impact itself, but that whiteness continued. It pushed itself through the cabin walls, through the shutters, before dying away. The shuttle jolted hard. The clock ticked past zero and continued counting. So I was not dead. But something had happened. Through half-blinded eyes, I saw that the shuttle's systems had all blanked out. There had only been one jolt, but my gut told me that the whole ship was yawing, out of control. I gasped, stunned by my own continued existence. Shocked, confused, and more than a little aggrieved that whatever redemption I had hoped for in the moment of my death was no longer for the taking. Slowly, my eyes recovered from the white pulse, and slowly the shuttle began to recover its own faculties. The console's indications came back on. There was some damage, but not nearly enough to be consistent with any sort of collision. The outer hull had taken the brunt of something, but it was not an impact. Then came a rain of blows, a soft succession of fistfalls and claw taps against the hull. It came and went. I began to understand. I had not needed to hit the incomer after all. In the last few seconds before the collision, the strain on its engines had finally taken its toll. The white flash had been the disintegration of the drives, which knocked my shuttle senseless, but had not destroyed it. I had sailed through the expanding debris cloud of the former ship. The shuttle was confused. It had been given a task, but now the object of that task no longer existed. "Null solution for Protocol 2. Null solution for Protocol 2. Null solution for Protocol 2. Revoke, zero, abort condition?" "Yes," I stammered out, still half breathless from the cold slap of my own survival. "Yes, sir. Revoke, zero, abort condition. Confirm revocation. Zero, abort condition now revoked. Awaiting orders." Orders. The idea seemed ludicrous. How was I supposed to come up with orders now? A few moments earlier I had scrubbed my mind of anything except the total acceptance of my own imminent end. Now I was expected to fumble around for the severed thread of my own life, find a purpose, and keep going.
I don't know, I said.
Just stabilize yourself. Maintain course and assess what the hell just happened, and call the missile back, if it's got enough fuel to meet us. 30 minutes passed while I carried on drifting past the point of the explosion. Then a chime came from the console. It was a soft tone, polite as a cough in a theater. The shuttle had detected something. It was not an update from the missile, nor a communication from Sun Hollow, or any of the Disciple observation satellites. But it was an electromagnetic signal, a repeating radio pulse, with an interval very close to exactly 1 second. I let the shuttle gather enough of these pulses to subject them to a close-grained analysis, looking for embedded content. There was nothing, just a smooth rise and fall, followed by silence, then another rise and fall. As we drifted, the shuttle was able to triangulate the pulse. It was moving away from the point where the incomer had blown up, but on a velocity vector much closer to my own, differing by only a few hundred kilometers per second. If it had been co-moving with the debris field, it ought to have been tens of millions of kilometers away from me by now, but it was not even 2 million astern of me. Something had survived the blast, or been ejected just before it happened. Something that was now putting out exactly the kind of signature that Sun Hollow had spent 30 years doing its best not to broadcast. A clear, repeating, and unambiguous indicator of functioning human technology. The wolves might or might not have been drawn to the explosion, but a systematic distress signal would be more than they could ignore. Unless that signal fell silent. Very quickly. The missile returned, sidling in from the darkness, then latching itself back onto the cradle. I brought it back into the weapons bay, then began to recharge its fuel tank from the shuttle's own supplies. It was time-consuming, but the only option. While the tank was reloading, I used a delicate but well-rehearsed procedure to extract the antimatter warhead from the front of the missile. The magnetic pen, and its associated arming and detonation system, was a fist-sized chunk of sterile metal, clean and gleaming as an artificial heart. It was much too valuable to waste against a target I fully expected to be easily susceptible to a pure kinetic energy strike. With that done, and the revised target loaded into the missile, I sent it back on its way, and waited. My plan was straightforward enough. I had already commenced a course alteration that would eventually bring me back to Sun Hollow. This far off the elliptic plane, I did not have nearly so much dust screening as when I had started out. My thrust bursts had to be done sparingly, at pseudo-random intervals, disguised as far as possible to blend in with Michael's own variability. After the missile had done its work, my course would bring me close enough to the impact point to inspect the field for any clues as to the nature of the transmitting source. I pushed aside thoughts of what that debris might point to. The missile was 30 minutes from its interception when the voice came through. It was a woman, speaking Canadian, the language most of us used in Sun Hollow.
Help me. Someone has to be able to hear this. Please. Help me.
The console confirmed that the voice was originating from the same position as the distress pulse. It was a faint signal, but just as problematic.
Stop talking,
I implored, as if she could hear me.
You're going to die. Don't complicate things.
The voice carried on.
I don't know where I am, or when, but something's happened, and I'm on my own. I think the ship. I think something happened to the ship. Something bad. If you can hear me and you're close by, I need you to help me. I'm cold. Getting colder. Please come.
Some spectral quality attended the voice, thin and otherworldly, as if it were not being made by a human larynx.
Are you wolf?
I whispered to the emptiness of the cabin.
Are you a trap designed to bait me into replying? I'm so cold. I don't think this is how it's meant to be. I can't move. Can't feel anything below my neck. I'm not even sure if I'm really speaking. I can hear myself, but I don't sound quite right. I sound like a ghost of myself.
Because you're dead, I said. I told the console to open a reciprocal channel back on the same frequency. Stop talking, I said again, but this time for her benefit. Stop talking and find a way to turn off that distress beacon. 12 seconds of silence. Then an answer.
Who are you? Can you help me?
Who I am doesn't matter. You're making a lot of noise, and it has to stop. I was making noise now as well, but at least the shuttle was tight, beaming my response in her direction only, minimizing the chances of it being scattered or intercepted. If you can't. But there was no if about it. I was going to kill her, whatever happened. Just turn off that distress beacon. You must still be in reefer sleep, but you've been raised to a minimum consciousness level. You should still be able to address the casket's command tree. Find a way to stop it pulsing and stop broadcasting your voice. The silence again, the lag caused by the distance between us. It stretched so long that I thought she might have taken my warning to heart. Then she said,
I'm frightened. I don't remember what happened. There was the ship, and then this. I don't even...
Stop!
Remember who I am.
Listen to me very carefully. This isn't a safe place. I have a duty to protect my people and you're endangering them.
Where am I?
Drifting. A long way from where you ever wanted to be. Now turn off that beacon.
I'm so cold.
20 seconds later, the beacon stopped. Either it had silenced itself, or she had found a way into the command tree. I permitted myself a sigh of partial relief. How much harm had been done it was impossible to say, but I was glad not to have that repeating tone coming from the console, and glad also not to have to expend our missile.
I think it's stopped now.
Good, I said beneath my breath. Now,
please help me.
I calculated a new course, called off the missile, and told it to put itself on a safe-keeping orbit again. We were due to pass through the same neck of space, but at vastly different times and speeds. There was no hope of re-intercepting it this time, but even without its warhead, the missile was worth preserving. It would take 3 weeks to reach her position. I crawled back into the torpor box, fixed the catheters and monitors back in place, and set the box to revive me when the shuttle was 2 hours out from contact with the drifting object. Her casket was floating free, long since separated from any other part of the debris field. It was tumbling slowly, presenting all its aspects to me. It was a round-cornered rectangular box, with a gristle of tubes and cables sprouting from one end of it. A reefer sleep unit, but not of a kind that was immediately familiar to me. From the damage at one end of the casket, the end opposite the passenger's head, I saw that it must have been ripped away from some cradle or chassis, perhaps supplying some function that the casket alone could not provide for itself. How long could it have kept her alive, without the sustenance flowing through those severed roots? I thought she would be doing well to last a few days, never mind the weeks that it had taken me to reach her. I crept closer. I used the shuttle's passive sensors alone, relying on ambient illumination. Never far from my mind was the possibility that this could still be a wolf trap of sorts, a clever imitation designed to bait me in. But the nearer I got, the less I thought that was likely. It was all too real, too convincing. There were scorch marks on the capsule, dents and gashes, a mass of scarred bubbling where some of its sheathing must have registered tremendous heat. A rectangular window lay at the intact end, roughly where the passenger's face would have been. There were grilled bars over the window, protecting the glass beneath. The casket's design looked robust, old-fashioned. The capsule continued tumbling. Floating beneath the window, was there something? A serene, sleeping face, balmed by Michael's ruddy light, just for an instant. I brought the shuttle to within a few meters of the casket. Meters, or kilometers. If it was a bomb, I was already far too close. I opened the weapons bay, then lowered the cradle, using the pincers to grasp at the casket and try and stop its tumbling. It was clumsy work, but after 20 minutes of fumbling the casket, losing it, chasing after it, I finally had it tamed sufficiently to bring back into the ship. It was good that there was no missile. There would have been no room in the bay otherwise. Luckily, the two objects were not too dissimilar in size and shape. I sealed the bay, repressurized it, and opened the inner door. The casket had come to rest with the window nearest to me, facing back into the ship. The sudden transition to atmosphere had laid a frosting across the glass beneath the grill bars, hiding whatever I thought I might have seen beneath. I had come prepared, a pair of headphones already settled over my ears. I attached a magnetic limpet to the casket's outer casing, then angled the microphone before my lips. "Can you hear me?" I asked, tentatively. "My name is Miguel de Reiter, the same man who spoke to you 3 weeks ago. I've brought you inside my ship. I've fixed a radio transmitter onto the outside of your casket, using the same frequency we spoke on originally. Make some response if any of this is getting through to you." There was no answer from the casket, but nor was I expecting one. I was going through the motions, mostly resigned to the passenger already being dead, which was another way of saying that she was beyond any possibility of safe revival. Death came in many shades. Everyone was dead at the deepest point of reef asleep. No thoughts, no cellular processes. But they could still be brought back to life, if the casket operated as it was meant to. If one of several things went wrong, though, then a wave of damage could sweep through those cells, rupturing them from inside, tearing apart the connections between them. In the brain, those connections encoded everything that was most dear to us about ourselves. A warm corpse, with a grey mush of scrambled neural pathways, was no better than a cold one. On other worlds, in better times, there had always been hope. In Sun Hollow, even extracting a tooth or setting a broken bone came with challenges. Remaking a damaged mind was a little beyond our capabilities. "Rest," I said, as if it mattered. "You're safe now, and I'm taking you back to our world." I left the magnetic limpet in place, the radio channel open. I went forward and began readying the shuttle for the rest of my journey home. A few thrust bursts, a course correction or two, some food in my stomach, and I could crawl back into the torpor box again. Someone else could worry about what to do with the macabre trophy I had brought back home. "Talk to me." Her voice was coming out of the console, relayed through the magnetic limpet. I dashed back to the weapons bay, grabbed a glove, and used it to swab away as much of the frost as I could from the grilled window. "I'm here," I said, speaking through the microphone. "Are you all right? Do you remember anything of the last 3 weeks?"
"Where am I?"
Her voice still sounded distant and not quite real. There was something too pure, too crystalline about it, like the notes that came off a wine glass when it was stroked by a wet finger. "In a ship. I rescued you."
"Rescued me?"
I peered closer, trying to get a better glimpse of the face beneath the window. But there was still too much fog on the inside of the glass. She hovered beneath, like a dark-eyed moon peeking in and out of threads of cirrus. "Something happened. You were on a ship, a much bigger ship than this one. There was an accident. Your ship blew up as it was coming into our system."
"An accident?"
"An engine failure. It seems you were blown free. I picked up a signal from your casket. Yours, but no one else's."
"There were others,"
she said distantly, as if half a memory had just presented itself.
"You have to search for them. I can't be the only one."
"I don't think there was anyone else. Even if there were, I'm afraid we don't have the means to look for them. You had a transmitter. No one else did."
"I want to get out of this thing. I feel numb."
"I don't have the means to help you until we're back in Sun Hollow. Once we're there, you'll be well taken care of."
"What is Sun Hollow?"
I moved around to the other end of the reef asleep casket, where most of the damage lay, and where numerous pipes and cables had been severed cleanly away. A place of safety. A small settlement on a world called Michaelmas, orbiting a star called Michael.
I don't know those names.
There's no reason that you should. With insulating gloves on, I examined the severed connections, trying to identify familiar technologies and functions. May I ask, do you remember anything about yourself?
There was the ship. They were putting us aboard it. Then they came to put us to sleep and said that when we woke up, we'd be somewhere else. My name's...
But she trailed off, unable to supply the answer she must have expected to come without effort.
I can't remember.
It'll come back, I said, fingering two thick lines that had alloy cores, suggesting that they were power umbilicals. If I said wolf to you, would that mean anything at all?
We had wolves in the hills above Zawinul's Landing. They'd come on one of the first ships. I'd listened to them when the moons were high.
These are different wolves, but it's good that you remember something of home. Zawinul's Landing. I said the word slowly, ruminatively. That's a place on Haven, I think. One of the first Demarchist settlements. Do you remember when you left there?
Not exactly. What did you say your name was?
I examined one of the other cables. It had a slippery, eel-like texture and seemed to want to coil itself around my fingers. Miguel de Reiter.
Are you a pilot?
No. I smiled at the idea. An administrator.
An important one?
I moved away from the casket in the weapons bay and tugged open a general service hatch in the wall of the shuttle. Behind the B-striped panel was a mess of power lines and sensor cabling. Like everything else on the shuttle, it showed clear signs of being repaired and adapted several times. Reasonably high up the food chain.
Then why did they send you?
I sent myself. I had brought a tool and repair kit with me to the weapons bay. I opened it and sifted through the items I would need to make some kind of improvised connection between the ship and the casket. I decided it would be feasible, if inelegant.
Are they really? All dead? Miguel de Reiter?
I think so.
Is it bad that I don't feel anything?
I turned back to look at the casket, troubled by her question but trying to find a way to deflect it. I'd say that it's entirely human. You wouldn't necessarily have known a single soul on that ship. On the Salmasis, many of us travelled alone, with no contact with the other passengers. We didn't begin to know each other until we founded the settlement.
And now?
We've become a community, a family, 5,000 strong. We have our differences, as in any family. Sometimes very serious differences. But there's a unity that binds us, a mutual understanding, a sense of our own fragility. Call it love. We have to look after each other if any one of us is to survive. We're vulnerable without the affection and support of our fellow citizens. Together, provided each plays their part, we're strong enough to wait out the wolves. We've been doing it for 30 years now, through thick and thin.
I think you must be a good man, Miguel de Reiter, to have left your family and come out here for me.
Then you think wrongly.
You risked your life, left your loved ones, for one passenger you didn't even know.
I was glad she could not see the tightness in my face. I had a job to do. Chapter 2. Another 6 weeks brought me home. By the time I emerged from torpor, a few hours out from Michaelmas, the shuttle was already on its final deceleration burn. There was no point signalling my arrival. I would have been tracked by the disciples all the way in, their updates alerting Sun Hollow to my imminent return. Even without the disciples, the sensors on Michaelmas would have picked up the profile of my ship and determined that I was nothing to do with the wolves. If I had been deemed to be some other kind of threat, a thing of human origin, taking too close an interest in Michaelmas, then I would already have been shot out of the sky by our defensive railguns. The fact that I was alive at all meant that I had been tracked and identified as a friendly asset. When the G-load had dropped enough to permit mobility, I went back and checked that my passenger was still secure and that she remained at the same level of reefer sleep as when I had gone under. The frosting beneath the window had cleared a little since I last saw her, and her face loomed more discernibly. She looked bloodless, as pale as a white paper mask. Her dark-rimmed eyes were closed, her lips sealed, her demeanour one of serene repose. I thought of a painting I had once seen, a drowned woman floating in water. I went back to nurse the shuttle down. Michaelmas was a dense rock, larger than Mars but smaller than Earth. Other than this short interlude of human habitation, it was doomed to be lifeless. It had no atmosphere, seas or ice caps. At no point in its extremely short life had any volatile materials ever rained down onto its crust. Nor would they. Michael's bad-tempered flaring episodes had banished all the life-giving compounds from the inner planetary system, never to return. Thus, Michaelmas suited us very well as a hiding place. The constant, continuing bombardment by rocky impactors meant that its surface was a scribble of overlapping craters, providing natural concealment for our surface emplacements, launch silos, and access shafts. Each impactor transferred some of its kinetic energy into the crust, warming it almost imperceptibly. Over time, that thermal background served as a camouflage for our own heat-generating activities. The crust rang like a bell, too, meaning that it would be very hard to detect human presence by remote seismography, scanning the surface with lasers or radar. Our own seismophones had to work hard to separate noise from signal with that ever-droning undertone. Beyond Michaelmas, the dust disk in which it swam provided additional cover, and when Michael grumbled out a flare, we tried to use it to conceal a launch, thrust boost, or signals burst. None of it was infallible. None of it was easy. We had come to Michaelmas not to found a colony, but to hide for as long as it took. Whether that was 30 years or 130 was beyond the bounds of discussion. It was simply an axiom of Sun Hollow that we waited as long as necessary, always with the understanding that this place of refuge was temporary. Each day that we added to our tally was an achievement, each year a triumph. The forward planners in Sanctum were tasked with looking into our long-term survival needs, but for most of the citizenry, that kind of thinking was actively discouraged. Concentrate only on the day ahead, and all the days after that will follow. Every few years threw us a crisis. Sometimes they were political, like the Rurik-Tain affair. Sometimes they were linked to a resource shortage, a systems failure, a chain of accidents. Sometimes, as with the passenger, it was an emergency related to something picked up by the disciples. We had come through this latest one and been spared our ultimate fear. Although a human incomer posed a serious threat to Sun Hollow, it was within our means to neutralize. One day, the disciples would see a more wolfish kind of shadow at the cave mouth. But not today, and perhaps not this year. We had come through again, and I had played a small part in that success. The shuttle fell, tail first, dropping to the surface. It was always an act of nerve, waiting for the crater floor to slide aside at the last moment, allowing the shuttle to sink into the underground silo. Sun Hollow allowed me in. The engines throttled down. The shuttle rocked slightly on its landing legs, then settled into stillness. There was never any air in the silo unless repairs needed to be done, but a pressurized connecting bridge pushed out from one of the walls, and before long, a figure sauntered along the transparent tube to meet me at the lock. Morgan Valois, plump in sheepskins, dangling a breather box.
"You're lucky, man, the writer."
"I am." Valois opened the breather box and took out a small bottle. He unstoppered it and held it out. A heavy odor wafted up my nostrils, settling into the space between my eyes. Already sensing brain cells beginning to wither, I took a polite swig for friendship's sake. I had no idea what was in the bottle, nor how Valois had come by it. But that concoction only came out on exceptionally rare occasions.
"You get to read your own obituaries. I think you came out of them looking tolerably well. I'm not dead. We know that now. In fact, we've known for about 3 weeks, once you popped back into our tracking network. But the obituaries were already written and duplicated. Too late to do anything about it now.
His eyes narrowed to a hard, penetrating curiosity.
Why in Michael's name didn't you signal back to us?
I didn't believe it was necessary. The disciples should never have lost sight of me.
They did. You know the system's not flawless. If the disciples occasionally lose track of one of our ships, that's actually a good thing. It means our stealthing measures aren't entirely pointless.
He waved a flustered hand near his brow.
Besides that, we've had glitches with the disciples while you were away.
Glitches? Never mind.
All will soon be mended, which is better than I dare speculate about the state of your marriage.
What about it?
You've put them through hell.
Oh, dear God. Are you saying they thought I was dead all those weeks? Valois took back the sacred bottle and returned it to its place of sanctuary. Any trace of bonhomie was gone from his face.
Nicola protected Victorine to the best of her abilities.
Of course, she clung to the hope that you were alive. But near the end, even she was starting to lose faith. He shook his head, his tone turning censorious.
You didn't have to inflict this on us, Miguel. If something happened out there, something that delayed your return, it would have been acceptable to signal us.
I stared at him. What do you mean, if something happened out there?
You know exactly what happened.
We inferred. We saw the ship blow up. Either your missile had hit it, or you'd gone to Protocol 2. When there was a silence, we had to assume the latter.
But the distress signal?
The what?
Is this a game, Morgan?
A test to see how well I cope with post-revival disorientation.
I assure you, it's no game at all.
There was a distress signal. Something contacted the ship. I investigated and found a drifting casket.
A casket?
He repeated carefully, as if taking notes in an interrogation, seeing how carefully I kept to one version of events. That signal was broadcasting all across the system. I had to silence it by any means. There's no way Sun Hollow didn't pick it up, let alone the disciples.
We didn't pick up any sort of distress signal.
Then it must have been unidirectional. I frowned through a headache, more than could be explained by the tiny sip I'd taken from his bottle. I don't know how it knew where to find me, but that's the only explanation. We can argue about this later. If you think I'm making this up, or delusional, I have all the evidence you need in the weapons bay. I found the drifter and brought her aboard.
How?
A passenger from the ship, which, incidentally, I didn't need to destroy. It blew up on its own, just as I was about to ram it. He lifted an eyebrow, the merest trace of admiration.
You were that close, in the end?
The missile veered off. No chance to return and refuel, so I put myself in the firing line. I lowered my voice. I was ready for it, Morgan. You'd be surprised how ready I was. How good it felt to know that I was about to make that sacrifice. The admiration turned as quickly to pity.
Until something robbed you of that chance for noble self-sacrifice. Unless you were there, you can't know what it was like.
He nodded slowly.
All right. I believe that much of it. I saw it in your face when you left. That need for expiation. Are you serious about this casket? You really brought something back with you.
More than just a thing. A survivor. I've spoken to her. She's not some radiation-blasted corpse in a box. Her casket warmed her enough for communication. She was on a ship from Haven.
One survivor? Out of how many?
She doesn't remember enough to be able to say. I'm hoping she'll remember a little more when we bring her out of reefer sleep.
And this fortunate soul. She's in hibernation now.
Her casket was damaged, but I plumbed it back into shuttle power for the trip home. She went back under. Valois nodded.
Good. Then she won't feel a thing when we kill her.
I knocked on my own door. It only seemed polite. A long interval followed, and although it was evening, and out of school hours, I wondered if Nicola and Victorine had made themselves unavailable, delaying the point when they had to see me again. I could not blame them for that. I had been anxious to see them, and at the same time desperate to postpone our reunion because of the difficult feelings we were all going to have to face. I was nearly ready to turn away from my own home to go back to Sanctum on some pretense of business when Nicola let me in. We held each other in the hallway, but there was a tentativeness to the embrace. When I kissed Nicola, she did not pull back, but neither did she rush to reciprocate.
"I am glad that you are back,"
she said quietly, as if there were a risk of Victorine overhearing from one of the adjoining rooms.
"More glad than I may be capable of showing right now. But you put us through something terrible."
I closed the door behind me and shrugged off the breather box and sheepskins I had worn on my way home through the caverns.
"Morgan says that you never lost hope that I was alive."
Nicola kept her voice low. There was a strain in it.
"Not losing hope is not the same thing as knowing you're alive, Miguel.
When we saw that explosion, what else were we expected to think?"
"I thought about signaling, but there's always a risk in any sort of communication. You do not need to tell me these things."
"No," I said softly. "You need to understand. That ship wasn't destroyed by my missile. Something else caused it. An engine failure, most likely. But I had to consider the other possibility, that there were wolves nearby. Maybe they hadn't seen me until that point, but it would have only taken one stray photon to give me away. From that discovery, they'd have found the disciples, and then they'd have found Sun Hollow."
"Don't over-dramatize."
"I'm not. If wolves had come, I wouldn't be talking to you now." I searched her face, hoping the cruelty of my words had served its purpose. It wasn't carelessness or thoughtlessness that stopped me signaling Nicola. It was love. I'd have died out there rather than give the wolves a lead on our location. Some rumination played behind her eyes.
"Morgan says you nearly sacrificed yourself."
The missile had failed. It was the only remaining way of stopping that ship. I sensed something change in her. Not forgiveness, not yet, but a step in the direction of forgiveness. It was the intention on which I pinned the first faint hope of reconciliation.
"How close did it come?"
"I'd made my peace."
"And then?"
"A burst of light. I was spared my sacrifice."
"What were you thinking of in your last moments?"
"Of you, here, alone, without me. I hoped you'd think well of what I'd done."
"It is not me that needs to understand it. I protected Victorine from the word of your death for as long as I could, but I could never shield her completely."
I nodded my agreement. It wouldn't have been fair.
"When at last the news reached her, which we all thought was the truth, she was shocked and saddened. But as the days passed, and she had contact with her friends, she saw that in the eyes of many you had become a hero. Miguel de Raita,
the man who gave himself to save Sun Hollow.
I think for that little while, she would have preferred to have been your daughter, not mine. But do you see what happened when you turned out not to be dead after all? You put her through another kind of grief. That figure that she had built up in her imagination died too."
"I can't help what happened," I said. "I can't help that I didn't die out there, or that I'm not the heroic martyr I never set out to be. All I know is that there was a threat, and now it's neutralized. And for a week, or a month, or however long it takes, some of us can sleep easily again." I stepped away from her, offering my palms. "That's all I have. I had a duty to Sun Hollow. I discharged that duty."
"Did you feel you had something to atone for?"
I started to lie, then decided Nicola deserved only the truth. "You were the one who said I had a guilty conscience. I'd have denied it, but part of me knew you were right."
"And now, has that burden lifted?"
"I think it has."
"I hope so, for all our sakes."
Her voice became stern, but beneath it was a thread of familial warmth.
"You will not go away again, Miguel. Promise me that, and make the same promise to Victorine. Can you do that?"
"I will do my best."
"Not good enough. I want a promise, here and now."
She took my hands in hers.
"As sacred as a marriage vow, you must not leave us.
You will not leave Sun Hollow until the day we all leave. Is that understood and agreed?" I nodded solemnly. "It is." My bones ache. I'd forgotten how hard it can be, and it was just a few weeks in space. "Someone else will go next time. That's my promise.
Good. Her fingers tightened. You mean it?
I do.
Your hand is shaking. How is the numbness?
It'll get better after a few days. At last, there was the easing in her that I had been hoping for.
You will say all these things to Victorine as well. She is waiting in the kitchen. When Morgan said that you were on your way, I prepared a meal. I was allowed an extra mutton ration on account of your return. Will you eat with us?
My eyes began to sting. Tears of gratitude and relief to be welcomed back into the love of a family.
Nothing would make me happier.
It could never be a normal meal, but it was far better than no reception at all. I made the same promise to Victorine that I had given to Nicola, and when she came back at me with 100 extra conditions, I accepted them without complaint. That settled, to her satisfaction at least, she began to probe me for the details of what had happened since my departure. Most of it I could answer straightforwardly, but I was still in no hurry to dwell on the topic of sacrificing myself. Instead, I glided around it, mentioning that the missile had gone wrong and that shortly afterwards the ship had blown up on its own.
Morgan told Mother that you found someone out there.
I did, I answered. A woman, the only survivor of the incomer.
No one else seems to know.
They don't, for the time being. Once we have a better idea of the incomer's condition, I'll make a public announcement. Victorine picked spinach from between her front teeth.
What's her name?
We don't know. We spoke to each other out there, but she was still frozen and her memory hadn't begun to come back properly.
Will it?
I very much hope so. There may be things she knows that can help us, even the simplest skill. Even if she doesn't remember everything and hasn't anything unique to offer us, she'll still be treated kindly, made welcome in our community. Victorine ate on in silence for a few mouthfuls.
Does she know you went out there to kill her?
Not her personally, Nicola put in on my behalf.
Does it matter?
Victorine asked, lifting her face to both of us.
Her, or one of the thousands of other people on that ship? Just because you didn't know any of them by name, it doesn't change the fact that the plan was to kill them all.
The ship had to be stopped, Nicola began. No. It's all right, I said, cutting her off gently. Victorine deserves to hear the unvarnished truth. I did mean to kill the passenger. There's no getting away from it. I meant to kill her and however many other thousands of people she travelled with. It doesn't matter if there were 50,000 of them and 5,000 of us. It's not a moral calculus. They had to die, no matter how many of them there were, no matter how virtuous they were, so that our survival wasn't put in jeopardy.
That makes us monsters,
Victorine said. It does, I agreed, undercutting her ire. It also makes us alive, and able to keep being alive. This is the key, Victorine. We've done it. We've proven to ourselves that we have the means to survive in Sun Hollow and to keep surviving. Every death, every injury, every hard lesson along the path that's brought us here, all of that would have counted for nothing if we'd permitted them to blunder into our system and draw the wolves with them. It's not nice, what we have to do, but until we know that we aren't the only surviving pocket of humanity, every decision we take has to be conducted in that cold light. It's not about us. It's about the thread that we carry, a link between the humanity of the past and the humanity of the future. If we break that thread, if we fail in our duty of self-preservation, we extinguish that future. Every hope, every dream, gone. It will be nothing but darkness until the end of time.
Did you come up with those words, or did someone in Sanctum do it for you?
You'll understand in time, I said.
I don't want to understand.
Afterwards, when Victorine had collected her paint box and gone to her room, and Nicola and I were cleaning up in the kitchen, she touched my wrist and said,
"She will get over it, Miguel. It's not that she blames you for coming back from the dead. Deep down, she is very glad. But for a few days, you became something else in her imagination, a figment no man could ever live up to, and now she has to deal with the reality again.
Thank you for speaking in my defense. I did not agree with your silence. You should never have put us through that.
even though Morgan said that you were right to expect that we should have worked things out for ourselves. But I believe in what you did, and what you set out to do. Those who think you had something to atone for, they are wrong, and so are you if you still think that way. She pulled me in, the wholehearted embrace I had been waiting for since my return. You are better than your detractors. You are a good man, Miguel de Reiter, and I am proud that I am your wife. In the morning I joined Morgan Valois and Alma Chung in Sanctum's infirmary. Like all our facilities, it was a rambling complex of makeshift, modular rooms and buildings tucked into a network of caves and caverns, hundreds of meters beneath the surface. Every part of it had been scavenged and repurposed from the hulk of the Salmasis. "I'm confused, Alma," my deputy administrator was saying as I made my entrance. "I could have sworn we spoke yesterday, but I must have slipped at least a day or two."
"We did," Chung answered tersely.
"Then why is Miguel here? He was encouraged to stay home and recuperate for at least 26 to 52 hours.
A suggestion he clearly decided was best ignored."
Chung, my head of planetary security, gave an unconcerned shrug. She had no time for these frivolities.
"I don't blame him in the slightest, given how quickly his prize is likely to emerge. He wants to see what he's brought back to us."
The three of us were looking into a glass-partitioned annex, where the passenger and her casket had been brought after my landing. The sterile, airtight recovery room contained a bed and the usual medical monitoring equipment. Not that much. But for the time being, the passenger was still in the casket. The reefer sleep unit had been wheeled in on a trolley, the sort we used for missile handling, and was now connected to a much more sophisticated battery of support systems. Two technicians, wearing masks and anti-contamination garments, were fussing around the connections, checking vital signs and taking notes on their bulky portable screens.
"Do we recognize the technology?" I asked.
"Older and more sophisticated than anything we brought here," Valois said, "but not so old that our earlier experience doesn't give us something to go on. Pre-plague, most likely, which doesn't mean we aren't taking all available safeguards. If you find something in Sun Hollow capable of being touched by the plague, let me know. We're deep in the Dark Ages, Morgan. No matter how far back things might have seemed to slip when she went under, we'll be a step less developed than anything she's prepared for. Have they got any further with that corrupted memory core? Different varieties of scrambled data, but all pointing in the same direction. A passenger manifest for someone embarking at Haven in 613, an adult female. Her name is Brianna Betancourt."
"We have a ship record as well," Chung said.
"Lighthugger Silence in Heaven. Bulk passenger, 5.5 megaton displacement. Commissioned 329, Demarchist Orbital Manufactory. Fanned, La Caille 9352. Engines and associated propulsion subsystems leased from the conjoiners, under the technology-sharing protocols of the Europa Accords."
"Good to have a name," I acknowledged.
But I was still trying to push away the fact of what the ship had been. An ark full of sleepers, on their way to some better world, some better future. "How long until we bring her out?"
"They've begun perfusion," Valois said. "Say 13 to 26 hours, before she's conscious and warm and safe to be moved to that bed. Even then she'll likely be weak, confused and amnesiac. Don't expect to be playing chess with her anytime soon."
Other than her memory, which was starting to come back, she sounded sharp.
"That was then," Valois cautioned. "We've tried opening that neural channel, and we'll keep trying as her brain comes back to life. But so far we haven't found a way in."
"It was some emergency function of the casket. If the casket no longer detects that it's at risk of failure, it won't invoke that neural interface."
"If that little trick was done with implants," Chung said, "she'll have to have them scooped out and incinerated before she takes a step out of that room."
I shook my head. "Be real, Alma. Even if she was a carrier, she'd be no threat to us."
"Point of principle, dear boy, just like your decision not to signal back to us," Valois answered loftily.
"Still, we've scanned the box as well as we can. There doesn't seem to be anything artificial inside her, nor any nasty surprises in the casket itself. We'll conduct a complete set of tests once she's out. but my best guess is that she's come to us without augmentation, innocent as the snow.
Innocence? Chung scoffed. That'll be a first for us. If you get a glimpse, tell me what he looks like.
A faint shudder came up through the floor. Beyond the glass, the technicians halted in their examinations. Valois, Chung, and I lifted our eyes to the breach light, up in the corner of the wall, waiting for the red flash and siren that would mean some part of Sun Hollow was losing air, venting out to the surface. None of us had breather boxes around our necks. Inside Sanctum, which could be pressure sealed in a few seconds, there was no need. Any impactor big enough to puncture Sanctum was not going to leave much in the way of survivors, nor any great need for government. The light stayed dim, and no siren came.
Perhaps she'll want to climb back into the casket when she finds out what sort of world she's woken up to, Valois said.
She'll be grateful to be alive at all,
Chung said, with a fierce lack of sympathy. Then, with a frowning squint,
she did know about the wolves, didn't she, Miguel?
I don't think she did.
Then what did her captain tell her they were running from?
Nothing. I don't think she had the first idea what had happened to that ship at any point since it left Haven. Chung was silent for a few seconds. I could almost feel the mesh of mental gears, the whirring simulations going on in her brain.
Something's been niggling me, Miguel, ever since you said you had a passenger. How the hell did she survive?
I nodded into the glassed enclosure. I'd say just barely. You've seen the damage to that casket.
Your closing speeds were on the order of 7,000 kilometers per second, Chung stated.
They were heading in, and I was heading out to intercept them, on a closely opposed vector, two fists closing. Of course we had a high relative velocity.
Yet from the shuttle's navigation log, we know that it was within your capabilities to rendezvous with the casket. The differential motion was much lower than your closing velocities.
You're quibbling about how a survivor came to us. I'm saying there's more to her story than simply being the one lucky soul who was thrown clear by that blast.
There's something else.
I thought there might be. The shuttle log confirms your account of the distress signal. I'm glad you didn't think I was making it up.
But we didn't pick it up, and neither did the other ships or disciples.
So it was aimed at me, and not them.
To aim it at you, Valois said,
picking up on Chung's point. She'd have needed to know where you were. But your account says that she didn't seem to know who you were or where you'd come from.
Maybe something in the casket was able to lock onto me automatically, without the passenger ever being aware of it.
Chung looked at me as if there were blood coming from my nostrils.
Something in that casket? Is that the best you can come up with?
It's not an interrogation, Alma, I stressed. And when we do start asking questions of the passenger, we won't be interrogating her either. We'll be treating her as what she is, the sole survivor of something harrowing, an honored guest, to be shown kindness and understanding. A functionary bustled up behind us.
Pardon me, sirs, I'm afraid your presences are requested in the Red Room.
What is it? Chung snapped back.
Something odd with the seismophones, picked up in the last few minutes.
You'd best come.